Chapter 6. My new life was as calm and unruffled as though I had been living among hermits. I lived more than 8 years with my new guardians, and I remember only very few occasions in which there were evening parties, dinners, or gatherings of friends and relations. With the exception of 2 or 3 people who came from time to time, the musician B, who was the friend of the family, and the people who came to see Alexandra Mihalovna's husband, almost always on business, no one came to see us. Alexandra Mihalovna's husband was always occupied with business and the duties of his office, and could only with difficulty contrive to get even a little free time, and that was divided between his family and social life. The necessity of maintaining important connections, which it was impossible to neglect, led him to show himself fairly frequently in society. People talked on all hands of his boundless ambition, but as he enjoyed the reputation of a businesslike and serious man, as he had a very prominent post, and as happiness and success seemed to dog his path, public opinion by no means denied its approval. It went beyond that, in fact. People always felt a special liking for him, which they never felt for his wife. Alexandra Mihalovna lived in complete isolation, but she seemed to be glad of it. Her gentle character seemed created for seclusion. She was devoted to me with her whole heart, and loved me as though I had been her own child. And with the tears not yet dry from parting with Katya, with a still aching heart, I threw myself eagerly into the motherly arms of my kind benefactress. From that time forward, my warm love for her has been uninterrupted. To me she was mother, sister, friend. She replaced all the world for me and cherished my youth. Moreover, I soon noticed by instinct, by intuition, that her lot was by no means so rosy as might be imagined at first sight, from her quiet and apparently serene life, from the show of freedom, from the unclouded brightness of the smile which so often lighted up her face. And so every day of my development made clear to me something new in the life of my benefactress, something which my heart slowly and painfully surmised, and together with this sorrowful knowledge my devotion to her grew greater and greater. She was of a timid disposition and weak will. Looking at the candid and serene features of her face, one would never have supposed that any agitation could trouble her upright heart. It was unthinkable that she could dislike anyone. Compassion in her always got the upper hand, even of repulsion, and yet there were few friends she was devoted to, and she lived in almost complete solitude. She was passionate and impressionable by temperament, but at the same time she seemed afraid of her own impressionability, as if she were continually guarding her heart, not allowing it to forget itself, even in dreams. Sometimes, even at her sunniest moments, I noticed tears in her eyes, as though a sudden painful memory of something rankling in her conscience had flamed up in her soul, as though something were keeping hostile watch on her happiness, and seeking to trouble it. And it seemed as though the happier she were, the calmer and serener the moment of her life, the nearer was this depression, the more likely to appear the sudden melancholy, the tears, as though some sudden crisis came over her. I don't remember one calm month in all the 8 years. Her husband appeared to be very fond of her. She adored him. But at the first glance, it seemed as though there was something unuttered between them. There was some secret in her life. At least I began to suspect it from the first moment. Alexandra Mihalovna's husband made a forbidding impression on me from the first. This impression arose in childhood and was never effaced. In appearance, he was a tall, thin man, who seemed intentionally to conceal the look in his eyes behind green spectacles. He was dry and uncommunicative, and even tête-à-tête with his wife seemed unable to find anything to talk about. He was obviously oppressed by society. He took no notice of me, and every time when we all three met in Alexandra Mihalovna's drawing-room for tea, I felt ill at ease in his presence. I would glance stealthily at Alexandra Mihalovna and notice with pain that she seemed to be hesitating over every movement she made, turning pale if she fancied her husband was becoming particularly cross and severe, or suddenly flushing as though she heard or divined some hint in something her husband said. I felt that she was oppressed in his presence, and yet it seemed as though she could not live without him for a minute. I was struck by her extraordinary attentiveness to him, to every word he uttered, to every movement he made, as though her whole soul longed to please him in some way, as though she felt she did not succeed in doing what he desired. She seemed to be entreating his approbation. The slightest smile on his face, half a word of kindness, and she was happy, as though she had been at the first stage of still timorous, still hopeless love. She waited on her husband as though he were dangerously ill. When he went off into his study after pressing the hand of Alexandra Mihailovna, at whom he always looked, as I fancied, with a compassion that weighed upon her, she was completely changed. Her movements, her talk, instantly became more light-hearted and more free. But a sort of embarrassment remained for a long time after every interview with her husband. She began at once recalling every word, as though weighing every sentence he had uttered. Frequently she turned to me with the question, had she heard right? Was that the expression Pyotr Alexandrovich had used? As though looking for some other meaning in what he had said. And it was perhaps not for another hour that she quite regained her spirits, as though convinced that he was quite satisfied with her, and that she had no need to worry herself. Then she would suddenly become sweet, gay, and joyful, would kiss me, laugh with me, or go to the piano and improvise on it for an hour or two. But not infrequently her joy would be suddenly interrupted. She would begin to shed tears, and when I looked at her in agitation, in trouble, and in anxiety, she would at once assure me in a whisper, as though afraid of being overheard, that her tears meant nothing, that she was happy, and that I must not worry about her. It would sometimes happen when her husband was away that she would suddenly begin to be agitated, would begin inquiring about him, would show anxiety, would send to find out what he was doing, would find out from the maid why the carriage was ordered and where he meant to drive, would inquire whether he were ill, in good spirits or depressed, what he said, and so on. It seemed as though she did not dare to speak to him herself about his business and pursuits. When he gave her some advice or asked her some question, she listened to him as quietly and was as overawed as though she were his slave. She very much liked him to praise something of hers, anything, a book or her needlework. She seemed flattered by this and seemed to be made happy by it at once. But her joy was boundless when he chanced, which happened very rarely, to fondle one of their two tiny children. Her face was transformed and beamed with happiness. And at such moments she sometimes let herself be too much carried away by joy in her husband's presence. She would be so emboldened as suddenly, without any invitation from him, to suggest, of course timidly and with a trembling voice, that he should listen to some new piece of music she had just received, or would give his opinion about some book, or even that he would let her read him a page or two of some author who had made a special impression upon her that day. Sometimes her husband would graciously fall in with her wishes, and even smile condescendingly at her, as people smile at a spoilt child whom they do not want to check in some strange whim for fear of prematurely troubling its simplicity. But I don't know why I was revolted to the depths of my being by those smiles, that supercilious condescension, that inequality between them. I said nothing. I restrained myself and only watched them diligently with childish curiosity, but with prematurely harsh criticism. Another time I would notice that he suddenly seemed to pull himself up, seemed to recollect himself as though he suddenly, painfully, and against his will, were reminded of something disagreeable, awful, inevitable. Instantly the condescending smile would vanish from his face, and his eyes would fasten on his nervously fluttered wife, with a look of compassion which made me shudder, which, as I now realize, would have made me wretched if it had been turned upon me. At the same minute the joy vanished from Alexandra Mihailovna's face. The music or the reading was interrupted. She turned white but controlled herself and was silent. There followed unpleasant moments, moments of anguish which sometimes lasted a long time. At last the husband put an end to them. He would get up from his seat, as though with an effort suppressing his emotion and vexation, and pacing two or three times up and down the room in gloomy silence, would press his wife's hand, sigh deeply, and in undisguised perturbation would utter a few disconnected words in which the desire to comfort his wife was evident, and would go out of the room, while Alexandra Mihalovna would burst into tears or would sink into a terrible prolonged melancholy. Often he blessed her and made the sign of the cross over her as though she were a child saying good night to him, and she received his blessing with reverence and gratitude. But I cannot forget certain evenings in the house, two or three only during those 8 years, when Alexandra Mihalovna seemed suddenly transformed, and anger and indignation was reflected in her usually gentle face, instead of her invariable self-abasement and reverence for her husband. Sometimes the storm would be gathering for a whole hour. The husband would become more silent, more austere, and more surly than usual. At last the poor woman's sore heart could bear no more. In a voice breaking with emotion, she would begin talking, at first jerkily, disconnectedly, with hints and bitter pauses. Then, as though unable to endure her anguish, she would suddenly break into tears and sobs, and then would follow an outburst of indignation, of reproaches, of complaints, of despair, as though she were passing through a nervous crisis. And then it was worth seeing with what patience the husband bore it, with what sympathy he bent down to comfort her, kissed her hands, and even at last began weeping with her. Then she would seem to recollect herself. Her conscience would seem to cry out and convict her of crime. Her husband's tears would have a shattering effect on her, and, wringing her hands in despair, with convulsive sobs she would fall at his feet and beg the forgiveness that was instantly vouchsafed her. But the agonies of her conscience, the tears and the entreaties for forgiveness went on a long time, and she would be still more timid, still more tremulous in his presence for whole months. I could comprehend nothing of these reproaches and upbraidings. I was sent out of the room on these occasions, and always very awkwardly. But they could not keep their secret from me entirely. I watched, I noticed, I divined, and from the very beginning a vague suspicion took shape in me that there was some mystery in all this, that these sudden outbreaks of an exasperated heart were not simply a nervous crisis, that there was some reason for the husband's always being sullen, that there was some reason for his double-edged compassion for his poor sick wife, that there was some reason for her everlasting timidity and trepidation before him, and this meek, strange love which she did not even dare to display in her husband's presence, that there was some reason for her isolation, her nun-like seclusion, that sudden flush and deathly pallor on her face in the presence of her husband. But since such scenes with her husband were very rare, since life was very monotonous and I saw her from so close at hand, since, indeed, I was developing and growing very rapidly, and much that was new was beginning to stir unconsciously in me, distracting me from my observations, I grew accustomed at last to the life and to the habits and characters surrounding me. I could not, of course, help wondering at times as I looked at Alexandra Mihalovna, but my doubts so far reached no solution. I loved her warmly, respected her sadness, and so was afraid of troubling her oversensitive heart by my curiosity. She understood me, and how many times she was ready to thank me for my devotion. Sometimes, noticing my anxiety, she would smile through her tears and make a joke herself at her frequent weeping. Then, suddenly, she would begin telling me that she was very contented, very happy, that everyone was so kind to her, that everyone she had known had been so fond of her, that she was very much distressed that Pyotr Alexandrovitch was always so worried about her peace of mind, while she was, on the contrary, so happy, so happy. And then she would embrace me with such deep feeling, her face would be lighted up with such love, that my heart, if I may say so, ached with sympathy for her. Her features were never effaced from my memory. They were regular, and their thinness and pallor only accentuated the severe charm of her beauty. Her thick black hair, combed smoothly down, framed her cheeks in sharp, severe shadow, but that seemed to make more sweetly striking the contrast of her soft gaze. Her large, childishly clear blue eyes, which reflected at times so much simplicity, timidity, as it were defencelessness, as though fearful over every sensation, over every impulse of the heart, over the momentary gladness and over the frequent quiet sorrow. But at some happy, unruffled moments, there was so much that was serene and bright as day, so much goodness and tranquillity in the glance that penetrated to the heart. The eyes, blue as the heavens, shone with such love and gazed so sweetly, and in them was reflected so deep a feeling of sympathy for everything that was noble, for everything that asked for love, that besought compassion, that the whole soul surrendered to her, was involuntarily drawn to her, and seemed to catch from her the same serenity, the same calm of spirit and peacemaking and love. So sometimes one gazes up at the blue sky and feels that one is ready to spend whole hours in secret contemplation, and that the soul is growing more free and calm, as though the vast vault of heaven were reflected in it as in a still sheet of water. When, and this happened often, exultation sent the colour rushing to her face and her bosom heaved with emotion, then her eyes flashed like lightning and seemed to give forth sparks, as though her whole soul, which had chastely guarded the pure flame of beauty now inspiring her, had passed into them. At such moments she was as though inspired. And in this sudden rush of inspiration, in the transition from a mood of shrinking gentleness to lofty spiritual exaltation, to pure stern enthusiasm, there was at the same time so much that was naive, so much that was childishly impulsive, so much childlike faith, that I believe an artist would have given half his life to portray such a moment of lofty ecstasy and to put that inspired face upon canvas. From my first days in that house, I noticed that she was positively delighted to have me in her solitude. She had only one child then, and had only been 12 months a mother. But I was quite like a daughter to her, and she was incapable of making any distinction between me and her own children. With what warmth she set about my education! She was in such a hurry at first that Madame Léotard could not help smiling as she looked at her. Indeed, we set about everything at once, so that we could not understand each other. For instance, she undertook to teach me many things at once, but so many that it ended in more excitement, more heat, and more loving impatience on her part than in real benefit to me. At first she was disappointed at finding herself so incapable, but after a good laugh we started again from the beginning, though Alexandra Mihailovna, in spite of her first failure, still boldly declared herself opposed to Madame Léotard's system. They kept up a laughing argument, but my new instructress was absolutely opposed to every system, declaring that we should find the true method as we went along, that it was useless to stuff my head with dry information, and that success depended on understanding my instincts and on arousing my interest. And she was right, for she was triumphantly successful. To begin with, from the first, the parts of pupil and teacher entirely disappeared. We studied like two friends, and sometimes it seemed as though I were teaching Alexandra Mihailovna, all unconscious of the subtlety of the method. So, too, arguments often sprang up between us, and I exerted myself to the utmost to prove that the thing was as I saw it. And imperceptibly Alexandra Mihailovna led me into the right way. But in the end, when we reached the truth we were pursuing, I would guess how it was, would detect Alexandra Mihailovna's strategy, and, pondering over all her efforts with me, sometimes whole hours sacrificed for my benefit, I fell on her neck and embraced her after every lesson. My sensibility touched and perplexed her. She began inquiring with interest about my past, wishing to hear it from me, and every time I told her anything she grew more tender and more earnest with me, more earnest because through my unhappy childhood I aroused in her not only compassion, but a feeling, as it were, of respect. After I had told her about myself, we usually fell into long conversations in which she explained my past experiences to me, so that I seemed really to live through them again and learnt a great deal that was new. Madame Léotard often thought such talk too serious, and, seeing the tears I could not restrain, thought them quite unsuitable. I thought the very opposite, for after such lessons I felt as light-hearted and glad as though there had been nothing unhappy in my life. Moreover, I felt, too, grateful to Alexandra Mihalovna for making me love her more and more every day. Madame Léotard had no idea that all that had hitherto surged up from my soul fitfully with premature violence was gradually in this way being smoothed out and brought into tuneful harmony. She did not know that my childish, lacerated heart had suffered such agonizing pain that it was unjust in its exasperation and resented its sufferings, not understanding whence they came. The day began by our meeting in the nursery beside her baby. We woke him, washed and dressed him, fed him, played with him, and taught him to talk. At last we left the baby and sat down to work. We studied a great deal, but they were strange lessons. There was everything in them, but nothing definite. We read, discussed our impressions, put aside the book and went to music, and whole hours flew by unnoticed. In the evenings, B, who was a friend of Alexandra Mihalovna's, would come, and Madame Léotard would come too. Often a very lively, heated conversation would begin about art, about life, which we in our little circle knew only by hearsay, about reality, about ideals, about the past and the future, and we would sit up till after midnight. I listened intently, grew enthusiastic with the others, laughed or was touched, and it was at this time that I learned in full detail everything concerning my father and my early childhood. Meanwhile I was growing up. Teachers were engaged for me from whom I should have learned nothing but for Alexandra Mihalovna. With my geography teacher I should have simply gone blind hunting for towns and rivers on the map. With Alexandra Mihalovna, we set off on such voyages, stayed in such countries, saw such wonders, spent such delightful, such fantastic hours, and so great was the ardour of both of us that the books she had read were not enough for us. We were obliged to have recourse to new ones. Soon I was equal to teaching my geography teacher, though I must do him the justice to say he kept to the end his superiority in exact knowledge of the degrees of latitude and longitude in which any town was situated, and the thousands, hundreds, and even tens of inhabitants living in it. Our teacher of history was paid his fees regularly also, but when he went away, Alexandra Mihalovna and I learnt history in our own way. We took up our books and were often reading them till far into the night, or rather Alexandra Mihalovna read, for she exercised some censorship. I never felt so enthusiastic as I did after this reading. We were both excited as though we had been ourselves the heroes. Of course, we read more between the lines than in the words themselves. Moreover, Alexandra Mihalovna was splendid at describing things, so that it seemed that all we read about had happened in her presence. It may perhaps have been absurd that we should have been so excited and sat up beyond midnight, I a child and she a stricken heart, weighed down by the burden of life. I knew that she found, as it were, a rest from life beside me. I remember that at times I pondered strangely, looking at her. I was divining much before I had begun to live. I had already divined much in life. At last I was 13. Meanwhile, Alexandra Mihalovna's health grew worse and worse. She had become more irritable. Her attacks of hopeless melancholy were more severe. Her husband's visits began to be more frequent, and he used to sit with her, as before, of course, gloomy, austere, and almost silent, for longer and longer periods. I became more intensely absorbed in her lot. I was growing out of childhood. A great number of new impressions, observations, enthusiasms, conjectures were taking shape in me. Certainly the secret of this family began to worry me more and more. There were moments when it seemed to me that I understood something of that secret. At other times I would relapse into indifference, into apathy, even into annoyance, and forgot my curiosity as I found no answer to any question. At times, and this happened more and more frequently, I experienced a strange craving to be alone and to think, to do nothing but think. My present stage was like the time when I was living with my parents, and when, before I had made friends with my father, I spent a whole year thinking, imagining, looking out from my corner into God's world, so that at last I became like a wild creature, lost among the fantastic phantoms I had myself created. The difference was that now there was more impatience, more wretchedness, more new unconscious impulses, more thirst for movement, for thrills, so that I could not concentrate myself on one thing as in the past. On her side, Alexandra Mihalovna seemed to hold herself more aloof from me. At that age, I could hardly be her friend. I was not a child. I asked too many questions, and at times looked at her so that she was obliged to drop her eyes before me. These were strange moments. I could not bear to see her tears, and often tears rose into my own eyes as I looked at her. I flung myself on her neck and kissed her warmly. What answer could she make me? I felt that I was burdensome to her. But at other times, and they were sad and terrible times, she would convulsively embrace me as though in despair, as though seeking my sympathy, as though she were unable to endure her isolation, as though I understood her, as though we were suffering together. But yet the secret remained between us, that was unmistakable, and I began at such moments myself to feel aloof from her. I felt ill at ease with her. Moreover, there was little now we had in common, nothing but music, but the doctors began to forbid her music, and books were a greater difficulty than anything. She did not know how to read with me. We should, of course, have stopped at the first page. Every word might have been a hint, every insignificant phrase an enigma. We both avoided warm, sincere conversation tête-à-tête. And it was at this time that fate suddenly and unexpectedly gave a new turn to my life in a very strange way. My attention, my feelings, my heart, my brain were all at once suddenly turned with intense energy amounting almost to enthusiasm into another quite unexpected channel, and, without realizing the fact, I was carried along into a new world. I had no time to turn round, to look about me, to think things over. I might be going to ruin. I felt that indeed. But the temptation was too great for my fear, and I took my chance, shutting my eyes. And for a long time I was diverted from the real life which was beginning to weigh upon me, and from which I had so eagerly and so uselessly sought an escape. This was what it was, and this is how it happened. There were three doors leading out of the dining room, one leading to the sitting room, another to my room and the nursery, and the third to the library. From the library there was another way out, only separated from my room by a study in which Pyotr Alexandrovich's assistant, his copyist, who was at the same time his secretary and his agent, was installed. The key of the bookcases and of the library was kept in his room. After dinner one day, when he was not in the house, I found the key on the floor. I was seized with curiosity, and, arming myself with my find, I went into the library. It was rather a large, very light room, furnished with eight large bookcases filled with books. There were a great number of books, most of which had come to Pyotr Alexandrovich by inheritance. The rest of the books had been added by Alexandra Mihalovna, who was continually buying them. Great circumspection had been exercised hitherto in giving me books to read, so that I readily guessed that a great deal was forbidden me, and that many things were a secret from me. That was why I opened the first bookcase and took out the first book with irresistible curiosity, with a rush of terror and joy, and of a peculiar, undefinable feeling. The bookcase was full of novels. I took one of them, shut the bookcase, and carried the book off to my room with as strange a sensation, with as much throbbing and fluttering of my heart, as though I foresaw that a great transformation would take place in my life. Going into my room, I locked myself in and opened the book. But I could not read it. My mind was full of another preoccupation. I had first to plan securely and finally my access to the library in such a way that no one would know, and that I should retain the possibility of getting any book at any time. and so I postponed my enjoyment to a more convenient moment. I took the book back, but hid the key in my room. I hid it, and that was the first evil action in my life. I awaited the results. They were extremely satisfactory. Pyotr Alexandrovich's secretary, after looking for the key the whole evening and part of the night, searching on the floor with a candle, decided in the morning to send for a locksmith, who, from the bunch of keys he had brought with him, made a new one to fit. So the matter ended, and no one heard anything more about the loss of the key. I was so cautious that I did not go into the library till a week later, when I felt perfectly secure from all suspicion. At first I chose a moment when the secretary was not at home. Afterwards I took to going into the library from the dining room, for Pyotr Alexandrovich's secretary merely kept the key in his pocket, and never entered into closer relations with the books, and therefore did not even go into the room in which they were kept. I began reading greedily, and soon I was entirely absorbed in reading. All my new cravings, all my recent yearnings, all the still vague impulses of my adolescence, which had surged up with such restless violence in my soul, prematurely stimulated by my too early development, all this was suddenly turned aside into a new channel that unexpectedly presented itself, as though fully satisfied by its new food, as though it had found its true path. Soon my heart and my head were so enchanted. Soon my imagination was developing so widely that I seemed to forget the whole world which had hitherto surrounded me. It seemed as though fate itself had stopped me on the threshold of a new life, into which I longed to plunge, and about which I spent my days and nights conjecturing, and before letting me step into the unknown path, had led me up onto a height, showing me the future in a magic panorama, in dazzling and alluring perspective. I was destined to live through that future by getting to know it first in books, to live through it in dreams, in hopes, in passionate impulses, in the voluptuous emotion of a youthful spirit. I began reading indiscriminately the first book that came into my hands, but fate watched over me. What I had learned and experienced so far was so noble, so austere, that no evil, unclean page could attract me. I was guarded by my childish instinct, my youth, my past. It was now that awakened intelligence, suddenly, as it were, lighted up my whole past life. Indeed, almost every page I read seemed to me as though it were already familiar, as though all these passions, all this life, presented to me in such unexpected forms, in such enchanting pictures, was already familiar to me. And how could I help being carried away to the point of forgetting the present, of almost becoming estranged from reality, when in every book I read I found embodied the laws of the same destiny, the same spirit of adventure which dominates the life of man, yet is derived from some chief law of human life, which is the condition of safety, preservation, and happiness. This law, which I suspected I strove my utmost to divine, with every instinct awakened in me almost by a feeling of self-preservation, it was as though I had been forewarned, as though someone were prompting me. It was as though something were stirring prophetically in my heart, and every day hope grew stronger and stronger in my breast, though at the same time my longings too grew stronger for that future, for that life which impressed me in what I had read each day, with all the power of art, with all the fascination of poetry. But as I have said already, my imagination dominated my impatience, and I was, in fact, bold only in my dreams, while in reality I was instinctively timid of the future. And therefore, as though by previous compact with myself, I unconsciously decided to be satisfied, for the time being, with the world of imagination, the world of dreams, in which I was the sole sovereign, in which there was nothing but fascination, nothing but delights, and unhappiness itself, if it were admitted, played a passive part, a transitory part, essential for the sake of contrast, and for the sudden turn of destiny that was to give a happy ending to the rapturous romances in my brain. That is how I interpret now my state of mind at that time. And such a life of the imagination, a life absolutely estranged from everything surrounding me, actually lasted for 3 whole years. This life was my secret, and at the end of 3 years I did not know whether to be afraid of its suddenly being discovered or not. All that I had lived through in those 3 years was too precious, too close to me. I was myself too closely reflected in all my imaginings, so much so that I might have been confused and frightened if any eye, no matter whose, had carelessly peeped into my soul. Moreover, we all, the whole household, led such an isolated life, so remote from society, in such monastic stillness, that each one of us must have become self-concentrated and have developed a craving for seclusion. That was what happened to me. Nothing about me was changed during those 3 years. Everything remained as before. Dreary monotony reigned as before among us, which, I believe, if I had not been distracted by my secret hidden life, would have been an agony to my soul, and would have driven me into some unknown and perilous path to escape from that spiritless and dreary circle, a path that might, perhaps, have led to my ruin. Madame Léotard had grown older, and was almost always shut up in her room. The children were still too little, B was always the same, and Alexandra Mihailovna's husband was as austere, as unapproachable, and as self-absorbed as ever. Between him and his wife there still persisted the same mysterious relation, which had begun to take a more and more grim and sinister aspect to my imagination. I felt more and more alarmed for Alexandra Mihailovna. Her joyless, colourless life was visibly wasting away before my eyes. Her health was growing weaker almost day by day. Despair, it seemed, had entered into her soul at last. She was obviously weighed down by something unknown, indefinite, of which she could not herself give an account, of something awful, though it was to her unintelligible, and she took it as an inevitable cross laid upon her life as a punishment. Her heart grew embittered at last in this mute anguish. Even her intelligence took a different direction, dark and melancholy. One thing I observed struck me particularly. It seemed to me that, as I grew older, she held herself more aloof from me, so much so that her reserve with me took the form, indeed, of a sort of impatient annoyance. It even seemed to me at some moments that she did not like me. It seemed as though I were in her way. I have mentioned that I had purposely taken to holding myself aloof from her, and once apart from her, I seemed as though I had caught the secretness of her character. That was how it was that all I passed through in those 3 years, all that was taking shape in my soul, in my dreams, in the knowledge I acquired, in my hopes and in my passionate transports, all was stubbornly kept to myself. Having once put up a screen between us, we never came together again, though it seemed to me that I loved her more every day. I cannot recall without tears how devoted she was to me, and how deeply she felt in her heart the obligation to lavish upon me all the treasures of her love, and to keep her vow, to be a mother to me. It is true that her own sorrow often distracted her from me. For long intervals she seemed to forget me, the more readily as I tried not to remind her of my existence, so that my 16th year arrived and no one seemed aware of it. But in her moments of lucidity, when she took a clearer view of what was going on around her, Alexandra Mihailovna seemed suddenly to be troubled about me. She would impatiently send for me from my room, would shower questions upon me about my lessons and my pursuits, as it were testing me, examining me, would not part from me for days together, would divine all my yearnings, all my desires, evidently thinking anxiously of my age, of my present and my future, and with inexhaustible love, with a sort of reverence, making ready to come to my help. But she was too much out of touch with me, and hence sometimes set to work too naively, so that I could too easily understand and see through it. It happened, for instance, when I was 16, that, after looking through my books and questioning me as to what I was reading, she seemed suddenly to take fright at finding that I had not yet got beyond the childish books suitable for a girl of 12. I guessed what she was feeling and watched her attentively. For a whole fortnight she seemed to be preparing me, trying to find out how far I was developed and how much I needed. At last she made up her mind to begin, and Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, which I had already perused at least 3 times, made its appearance on our table. At first, with timid expectation, she kept watch on my impressions, seemed to be weighing them, as though she were apprehensive of them. At last, this strained attitude between us, of which I was only too well aware, vanished. We both grew excited, and I felt so happy, so overjoyed that I could be open with her. By the time we finished the novel, she was delighted with me. Every observation I made during our reading was true, every impression was correct. In her eyes, my development had made strides already. Impressed by this, delighted with me, she was gladly intending to undertake my education once more. She did not want to part from me again. But this was not in her power. Fate soon parted us, and prevented us from being close friends again. The first attack of illness, the first attack of her everlasting depression, was enough to do this. And then followed again estrangements, reserves, mistrustfulness, and perhaps even exasperation. Yet even at such periods there were moments when we were carried away, reading, a few sympathetic words passing between us, music, and we forgot ourselves, spoke freely, spoke sometimes too freely, and afterwards felt ill at ease with each other. When we thought it over, we looked at each other as though we were frightened, with suspicious curiosity and with mistrustfulness. Each of us had a line up to which our intimacy could go, but which we did not dare to overstep, even if we had wished. One day in the evening, just as it was getting dusk, I was reading inattentively in Alexandra Mihalovna's study. She was sitting at the piano, improvising variations on an Italian air which was a favourite of hers. When she passed at last to the tune itself, I was so carried away by the music that I began timidly, in a low voice, to hum the tune to myself. Soon, completely carried away, I got up and went to the piano. As though she saw what I wanted, Alexandra Mihalovna began playing the accompaniment and lovingly followed every note of my voice. She seemed struck by its richness. I had never sung in her presence before, and indeed I scarcely knew my powers myself. Now we were both stirred. I raised my voice more and more. I was roused to energy, to passion, intensified by Alexandra Mihalovna's delighted wonder, which I perceived in every touch of her accompaniment. At last, the singing ended so successfully, with such fire and power, that she seized my hands in delight and looked at me joyfully. "Annetta! Oh! But you have got a beautiful voice," she cried. "My goodness, how is it that I haven't noticed it?" "I have only just noticed it myself," I answered, beside myself with joy. "God bless you, my sweet, precious child. You must thank him for this gift. Who knows? Oh, my God, my God!" She was so touched by this surprise, in such a state of delight, that she did not know what to say to me, how to make enough of me. It was a moment of openness, mutual sympathy and close intimacy, such as we had not had for a long while. Within an hour it seemed as though the house were keeping holiday. B was sent for at once. While we were waiting for him to come, we opened some other music books at random, which I knew better, and began a new air. This time I was shaking with nervousness. I did not want to spoil the first impression by failure. But soon my voice grew steadier and encouraged me. I was myself more and more astonished at its strength, and this second trial dispelled all doubts. In her impatient delight, Alexandra Mihalovna sent for her children and their nurse, and at last, completely carried away, went to her husband and summoned him from his study, which she would hardly have dared to dream of doing at other times. Pyotr Alexandrovich received the news graciously, congratulated me, and was the first to declare that I ought to have singing lessons. Alexandra Mihalovna, as delighted and grateful as though something wonderful had been done for her, flew to kiss his hand. At last B arrived. The old man was delighted. He was very fond of me. He talked of my father and of the past, and when I had sung before him two or three times, with a grave and anxious air, even with a certain mysteriousness in his tone, pronounced that I certainly had a voice, and perhaps talent, and that it was out of the question to leave me untrained. Then, as though on second thoughts, Alexandra Mihalovna and he decided that it was risky to praise me too much at first, and I noticed how they exchanged glances and plotted together on the sly, so that their whole conspiracy against me was exceedingly naive and awkward. I was laughing to myself all the evening, seeing how they tried to restrain themselves later on when I had sung again, and how they even went out of their way to remark on my defects. But they did not keep it up for long, and B was the first to betray himself, growing sentimental again in his delight. I had never suspected that he was so fond of me. We had the warmest, the most affectionate conversation all the evening. B told us of the lives of some celebrated singers and musicians, speaking with the enthusiasm of an artist, with reverence and with emotion. Then, after touching upon my father, he passed to me, to my childhood, to Prince X, to his family, of whom I had heard so little since my parting from them. But Alexandra Mihalovna did not know much about them herself. B knew more than the rest of us, for he had paid more than one visit to Moscow. But at that point the conversation took a somewhat mysterious turn that was a puzzle to me, and several circumstances, particularly affecting Prince X, were unintelligible to me. Alexandra Mihalovna spoke of Katya, but B could tell us nothing particular about her, and seemed as though intentionally desirous of saying nothing about her. That struck me. Far from having forgotten Katya, far from having lost my old feeling for her, I did not even dream that Katya could have changed. The effect of separation and of the long years lived apart, in the course of which we had sent each other no news, and of the difference of bringing up, and of the difference of our characters, escaped my notice. Katya was, in fact, never absent from my thoughts. She seemed to be still living with me, in my dreams particularly, in my romancings, and in my imagined adventures. We always went hand in hand. While I imagined myself the heroine of every story I read, I immediately put beside me my friend Katya, and immediately made the novel into two, of which one, of course, was my creation, though I cribbed unsparingly from my favourite authors. At last it was settled in our family council that a teacher of singing should be engaged for me. B recommended someone very well known, one of the best. Next day an Italian called D arrived. After hearing me, he confirmed his friend B's opinion, but declared that it would be far better for me to go to him for lessons, together with his other pupils, that emulation, imitation, and the various resources that would be at my disposal there would assist the development of my voice. Alexandra Mihalovna gave her consent, and from that time forth I used to go 3 times a week, at 8 o'clock in the morning, to the conservatoire. Now I will describe a strange adventure, which had a very great influence upon me, and with an abrupt transition began a new stage in my development. I had just reached my 16th year, and with it an incomprehensible apathy all at once came over my soul. I was sunk in an insufferable, miserable stagnation, incomprehensible to myself. All my dreams, all my yearnings seemed suddenly numb. Even my dreaminess vanished as though from impotence. A cold indifference replaced the former ardour of my inexperienced heart. Even my gift, greeted with such enthusiasm by all whom I loved, lost its interest for me, and I callously neglected it. Nothing interested me, so much so that I felt even for Alexandra Mihalovna a cold indifference, for which I blamed myself, since I could not help recognizing it. My apathy was interrupted from time to time by unaccountable melancholy and sudden tears. I sought solitude. At this strange moment, a strange adventure shook my soul to its depths and transformed the dead calm into a real tempest. My heart was bitterly wounded. This was how it happened.